Well, it's Monday all day, unfortunately or fortunately. I don't know. Sometimes Monday feels unfortunate, but for the Cleveland Guardians, a Monday might feel good considering the weekend they just had against the Boston Red Sox. We'll dive into that a little bit in addition to our usual prospect talk because this is Guardians of the Future, and I'm Justin Latta, and I'm back with Willie Hood for another fun week to talk about the minor league system, and we're going to get into some draft stuff today, which is always fun, and that's when Willie gets to talk, and I shut up for a while because I don't know anything about the draft, and Willie does. But so you all can listen to him espouse about the draft and hear more of his voice this week, and we'll start off with some talk from the previous series. Willie, how you doing? Did you enjoy the butt-whooping the Red Sox gave the Guardians over the weekend?
No, that wasn't fun at all.
It was quite a change after I shouldn't say they got their butt whooped. I mean, let's be honest. They had a fantastic road trip against the Twins, yes, the Dodgers, and the Colorado Rockies. Even though the Rockies aren't a good team, that's a hard place to play. And then they went out to LA, did well, even though they didn't have Jose Ramirez for two games. Then they took first place briefly against the Twins. That was good. And then kind of a letdown against the Red Sox. I mean, they were, maybe one or two hits or plays short on Friday and Saturday, and then Sunday just got away from them, obviously. But it's a young team. They were not going to keep that streak up forever. They weren't going to continue to come back from the seventh inning on against good teams for two straight weeks. That's almost hard to ask of anybody, let alone when you have the youngest team in baseball. And I'm not saying, you know, they didn't make mistakes and it's only because they're young, but I think it is because they're young, because, you know, you're not going to expect that from a lot of good teams to do what they did against the Twins and then do the same thing with the Red Sox. So I was saying yesterday on Twitter that you can't have the football mentality where, you know, it's fun. It's fun to see all the fans engage. It's good that there's a lot of people on Twitter who are excited about the team, and they should be, coming off that great road trip. But with the letdown against the Red Sox, you can't take that football mentality that, oh, we're not good and the team's not good and they need this and they're not a contender. But it's a young team. That stuff's going to happen, and you can't, I don't know, you can't let three games, even if it's a sweep at home, you can't let that overshadow a 7-2 road trip against two very good teams. You know, I think you have to take all that into consideration instead of just getting down about three games.
Absolutely. And across their last 25, they were 17-8. That includes losing the last four. So they were 17-4 at one point in time. A hot streak with a young team, it was going to come to an end. They ran into the Red Sox at home, and I can't help but wonder if a part of it was just a little bit of a letdown coming back home. And you had spent all of that energy, the emotion, all of it. I think it kind of catches up to you after a while. And then trying to sweep or trying to pace yourself and get a couple of games ahead on Minnesota if you can, you know, and actually being in first place there for a day or two. To me, there's a lot of energy that was spent with that, and then coming back home to play Boston, and Boston is a really good team. So, I mean, or at least they have very good players.
No, I mean, they played well. Boston played well. I mean, yeah, like the bullpen gave up some inopportune hits at some times. I mean, Cal Quantrill on Friday was not super great. He had issues with his command or control, I should say. And you know, they had the lead at one point, and then the bullpen kind of gave it up. That's going to happen with a young bullpen. The bullpen's been great all year, and they had a couple hiccups. Saturday, you know, Shane Bieber threw one bad pitch, and it led to three runs, and they couldn't come back. You know, everybody kept waiting and Friday night, they got down late, big, and they almost came back. They had the bases loaded for Jose Ramirez in the ninth inning, representing the winning run, and he grounded out. I mean, you can't script that any better. That's the guy you want up with the bases loaded down by three. It didn't happen because, look, they did it, three times against Minnesota in 2 days where they came back from, you know, major deficits, and you're just not going to, I mean, even the best teams don't do that all the time. And this is, like I said, this is a young team. And then Sunday, like I said, everything got away from them. So it just felt like, you know, I know Owen Miller had bad points at first base, and Josh Naylor is a little bit dinged up, so he's not playing a ton right now. You know, Jose Ramirez doesn't look like – he had two doubles yesterday, but he doesn't look like as comfortable as he normally is because of that thumb. Stephen Kwan's, you know, got some dings and dents, it sounds like, and, you know, there's Naylor. Yeah, Naylor Kwan has been – yeah, I mean, look, it was definitely a disappointing series, without a doubt, but now they got Minnesota coming in here, and they got to play good again, and I think it just underscores that if this team is a contender, which – you know, they're a game out of first place. They definitely need some reinforcements, depending on where that comes from. We'll get into that. But I don't think you could just, you know, take the woe is me attitude that, oh, the team's not good because they got swept by Boston and, you know, they're not going to be good. But, you know, that, like you said, they were 21-4 at one point over a stretch. And, you know, you're gonna run into this, whether you're a good team, a bad team, or a young team. You're going to have those stretches. And you're not going to keep that momentum up forever. So it's going to be important to see how they respond this week in a 5-game series against the Twins.
The most telling series was the one against the Dodgers, who I think is probably one of the premier organizations in baseball, for a lot of different reasons. Obviously they have resources, but also are excellent at developing. They just have a good baseball team, and Cleveland went and won. And if I remember, they swept that series.
Two out of three.
Okay. I knew that they won the series. I couldn't remember if they swept it or not. But that one was the most playoff-like atmosphere to me out of all the series in the last month, that encouraged me to think, hey, this team could be a contender, but they need a couple more pieces. The thing is, you know, couple more pieces will come. It's going to come out with a cost eventually. You know, we can talk about that here in a few minutes, though.
Yeah, well, this is the opportune time to do that. It depends on really how they want to approach it. I don't know. Like, it's going to be a tough decision no matter what they do with the trade deadline 5 weeks away, or I guess 6 weeks away at this point, because it's the last weekend in July or August 2nd. I mean, you know,
let me float a question out to you, Justin. Is this organization a year ahead of their timeline right now?
Yeah, that's a good question, right? I mean, I don't know if they thought that Stephen Kwan was going to be this good this right away. I mean, obviously he made the opening day roster and had a great April, didn't have a great May, but he's responded. I don't know if they expected Oscar Gonzalez to be like this, and I think, you know, we'll see if he keeps that up. Andrés Giménez is blossoming. Mm-hmm. Josh Naylor is having a career year. They're winning without Franmil Reyes being impactful, though I thought he looked good on Sunday. He had a couple nice at bats. You know, Owen Miller was good early, and he's kind of been a little average as late. And the pitching still hasn't been good as far as the starting pitching. So they're winning despite the fact that they're not dominating with starting pitching like they normally do. So, yeah, I would guess so. I mean, did you expect a bullpen of, like, I mean, not that they're as good as Miller, Shaw, and Allen were in 2016, 2017, but did you expect to be seeing a dominant bullpen led by Emmanuel Clase, Eli Morgan, Sam Henches, and Trevor Stephan? Did you think that was going to be the big four of the bullpen that was going to lead this team to a winning record on June 27th or 28th?
No. Lord, no.
I don't know if they did. I really don't know if they did. I mean, it's pretty hard to believe that they would have thought that bullpen was going to be as good as it was. So it's been a pleasant surprise for sure. But, yeah, they maybe are a year ahead. But the problem is, being a year ahead is, yes, they can contend. B, they need pieces. And C, they have to make a trade no matter what, because, man, the 40-man roster just – it's absolutely insane, and it's going to be even crazier this off season. I had someone in my mentions over the weekend telling me that the organization is just going to keep collecting prospects and never going to be buyers. And, you know, they never trade for anybody. Like everyone, he was like, oh, they were supposed to trade for a controllable outfielder last year, and they didn't.
I have a bobblehead of this guy named Andrew Miller. You know, when they were ready to push all in, they did, and they gave up prospects, and a lot of people were upset about that, you know. So I suspect when that happens this time and they are potentially either playoff contenders or World Series contenders and they push in, then there's going to be fans that are crying because they gave up Brian Rocchio or they gave up Daniel Espino or Gavin Williams. I'll be the one crying if they give up those guys. But I'll blame it and say it was somebody else.
I remember the trade the morning that Andrew Miller trade went down, and I was like, wow, this is A, it's a great trade, but B, wow, it hurts to be losing Clint Frazier, because I really thought that Clint Frazier was a future all-star, because clearly I'm very good at predicting this stuff, because I had Clint Frazier as a future all-star, and I had Oscar Gonzalez as a non-impact player, which, you know, so far both of those players have proved me wrong, so clearly I'm very good at this. But yeah, I remember being pretty upset about that trade.
I liked Austin Meadows better than I liked Frazier in that draft class. Frazier is a good player, or he was, and then concussion issues in New York happened to him. So I think a lot of it is timing and where a player lands, what organization a player lands with, too, that can affect their professional career. But
well, the hard part about the trading deadline is like, okay, do you upgrade from Ahmed Rosario? I guess you could do that, or you could just move Andrés Giménez to short and upgrade at second base, or you got to keep that open for Tyler Freeman, or you keep it open for Gabriel Arias and move Giménez back to second, or you have Brian Rocchio or Jose Tena. That's so hard to figure out which way they're going to pivot that way. Do they need another outfielder? You know, Miles Straw has been struggling after they gave him that contract. Somebody asked me too if they were going to flip, if Will Brennan was going to come up and Miles Straw is going to go down. And I said, no, I don't think so. That would be kind of crazy. And, you know, you can upgrade a catcher long term, you can upgrade a catcher short term. There's, you know, options out there for both of those scenarios. I think if they trade for a starting pitcher, it's going to be controllable because this team almost never gets rentals. Like, the only rentals I can really think of were what? Joe Smith and Jay Bruce. And that was 2017 when they were. No.
Outfielder from the Cubs.
What did you just say?
Fukudome, I think his name was. The outfielder from the Cubs. I can't remember his name.
That's an insult that you said that was an upgrade of any sort. That's an insult.
It was a trade for a rental.
Yeah, there was also a trading deadline in like 2012 where they traded for
Martin was another one.
Oh yeah, Leonis Martin was an upgrade. That was 2018. That was not a big one, but it was a trade. I think they got a reliever that year too. I remember the year they traded for Brent Lillibridge, and that was supposed to be an upgrade, and it was not because the farm system was still terrible. But the farm system is as good as ever. They can literally trade for anybody they want, I think, if they were engaged in any kind of talks. I'm pretty sure they could put together a package to entice just about anybody to say yes, but it depends on where they are. There's places they can upgrade. It just depends on how they want to go about it and, you know, how they see the next 5 years playing out. That's why being a year ahead is complicated, but they have to clear spots. It's going to be interesting. I think part of that is, this is the first thing I wanted to bring up, was I know you saw this. John Kenzie Noel was promoted to Double A Akron last week. Definitely did not see that coming. And then the day before, somebody on Twitter asked me, you know, oh, well, they should bump Noel to AA and do this and move Valera to AAA. And, you know, because they had just released a couple players. I think it was Jonathan Engelman in Akron who got released, unfortunately. And they asked if it was a precursor to Noel going to AAA. And I said, no, because he's not ready. He's hitting, you know, 219 with a 286 on base in Lake County. He's striking out 30% of the time. That is not a guy to me that's ready to face AA pitching. And the next day, they promoted him to AA. So what do I know? I still don't think he's ready for AA pitching. I know there are cases where guys have certain numbers at a lower level, like in terms of the lower part of the minors, and some of those things improve because that the quality of the pitching improves, but along with quality of pitching improving also means guys are in the zone more, and maybe he doesn't need to chase as much because there's not as many guys that are unable to throw strikes. I don't know, but I'm not sure if I believe Noel's ready for double-A pitching. We're going to find out, though, and you know, maybe he'll make me look stupid and, you know, go the Oscar Gonzalez path. It wouldn't be a shock, right?
Well, there's that. But I think that he probably struggles for the first couple of months and then starts to pick up toward the end of the season and will take off next year. I don't think he was ready for the jump to double A, but I see the necessity of jumping him to double A because that clock is ticking on him. You got three options, and they're going to want to get him against the highest level competition and get him acclimated as quickly as possible. So you're actually using your options for something, you know, that higher level development. That lower level development is not a place where you want to be burning options. You want to burn options at double or triple A for that development. So I don't think he's ready yet, but, you know, still an intriguing guy with massive power. And you know, here's the thing, very young for the level too. So he is likely to get exposed and look bad and have bad streaks. But I also think that he's a guy that's going to adjust. And that was something I picked up from him in Lynchburg last year, watching him, as he did adjust to the breaking pitches and guys throwing sliders in on his hands, and was able to hit a couple of really long home runs off of some of them once he did make a few adjustments. And when he saw a pitch a couple of times, he was able to time it up the second and third time that he saw it. I did catch that from watching him last year. And I think, you know, making that jump from low A now to where he is in double A, you know, you're going to see guys in the zone more, as you said. So I think as long as he's timing them up, he may get an opportunity to tee off on a few guys on occasion. But I do suspect that he's going to struggle that first month or two, maybe even longer. He may struggle out the rest of the season. But I do think there's going to be some encouraging times for him. And then I expect a jump from him next year.
Yeah, he had three hits in the first two games. He had a double and a couple of singles and scored two runs. So the first weekend, at least, was good for him. In nine plate appearances, but you're right. I'm glad you brought up, you know, being young for the level too. And yes, he needs to be promoted quicker because he's on the 40, he's 20, and he was only in high A for the second half last year. So it's an interesting case. And he's only got, you know, two seasons now where he's playing outside of the complex league. I don't know if he quite fits this bill, but I remember Eric Longenhang at the Fangraphs bringing this up, that sometimes guys will, this is going to be a really funny quote because this is verbatim. I'm not making this up. Okay. they will promote guys to higher levels, from their age. So he's 20 and in double A, over promoting guys who are young for the level to AK. What was the quote? Make the models horny is what he called it, because you know, when you have a guy playing at a higher level, like Andre Jimenez was mentioned in this column, you know, he's young for the level and he's hitting. it makes the models for a player's future predictions go a little bit haywire because they see this guy who's 20 years old handling AAA pitching or whatever, and better than most guys would. So it makes the models turn out differently for how you would predict that player's future going forward. So I don't know if Noel necessarily fits that criterion, but I am interested to see if it's a route they're taking that, I don't know, kind of inflates his value.
I was wondering and thinking about that myself, if a promotion to double A impacts his value in terms of his age for level, his ability to hit that's already present, going into a season knowing that you could potentially trade him as a valuable commodity. Even if he's scuffling, you still have the excuse that you have a 20-year-old in double A. And I think average age in double A is 24, so he's significantly younger than the level. I wouldn't have worded it that way.
The only reason I use that wording is because I remember the wording on Fangraphs. I will find the link to the article and put it in the podcast description just so everybody knows I didn't make that up.
Yeah, but I see Langenhagen's point is that there is sex appeal there, so to speak, for model-driven teams of, hey, here's this really young player performing at a high level or performing adequately at a high level, which will make the model forecast him better, you know, in the future. I was already kind of running that through my head in layman's terms.
Maybe I should let you bring that topic up.
Langenhagen graciously extrapolated that for us.
Very eloquent, yes, very eloquent. Hey, yeah. it was an entertaining read, and I never considered that point before. To be honest with you, I never thought teams did that. I never really like looked into that, and then he brought that up, and he was on Andres Jimenez was one of the examples, and I was like, well, that makes a lot of sense that model-driven teams would be more enticed by a younger player performing well at a higher level than they should be at, even though maybe they don't necessarily have the juice that you think they would based on that performance, that maybe it's just overinflating their value by doing that. And I don't know. I'm not saying Cleveland's trying to set it up where they can trade Noel based on that, but I think he's an interest. I know he's got the most power in the organization. A lot of people don't want to see him get traded because he is the best power hitter, I think, in the minors they have, and they've had it a long time. But they're at a position where they could add a first baseman, or, you know, Josh Naylor's playing well enough. Maybe he is the future at first base, so you've got to give up a guy like Noel, and you're comfortable with that because this organization loves middle infielders, not necessarily corner infielders. They've been moving Noel to right field and left field, and, you know, they're doing all these different things. And I don't know if it's a way to increase his value or if it's a way to get into the big league somehow, but it's probably both of those, honestly.
You're not going to develop a guy for somebody else. You're developing him for how he fits your organization. So I don't think all of this.
Well, you're developing him for a model. Developing him based on a trade value. I mean, if you can convince a team that he can play first base and the outfield versus just a first baseman, he's got a little bit more value. So I think you're doing it for A, your own organization, but B, for his trade value.
Sure. Well, I think you always have to look at that, particularly with your minor leaguers, but it also gives them positional flexibility in the future, which is something that Cleveland is promoting. Look at a guy like David Fry, who has played catcher and around the infield before, and now he's back to playing catcher again.
Well, that took an injury, yeah, but finally. You're right. Well, the development too, I guess, to the point about Noel, is you're right. You're developing for yourself, but also you have to get his bat in the lineup and the position Cleveland's in with, like, you know, Joe Naranjo at first base and Micah Priest is at first base and Akron playing well right now. You can't fit Noel's bat in the lineup at either those levels at first base every day because of those guys. So you want to keep his bat in the lineup somehow. And they tried third base. That didn't go well. They gave up on that experiment, thankfully, because it was painful. He's been, I don't know, fine in the outfield. I think he can do it. I mean, I don't think he's going to be great out there, but I don't think he's going to be, you know, the worst outfielder we've ever seen. So you keep his bat in the lineup regardless. But I don't know. It's really going to be interesting to see what happens with him the rest of the year and the next couple of years, considering his age and where he's at in the level, and the options make him a more difficult case than most. Speaking of Micah Priest, how about that? He was one player of the week this past week, Willie, at Akron. He was, I think he had 2 homers, 2 doubles, 10 RBI. He's really heated up. He had a tough start to the year, and the strikeout rate is a little bit high because of that. And the only thing I remember thinking about him going into this year at Double A was that there's some swing and miss in his game a little bit. And, you know, he missed all of 2019 after he was drafted because of the, I think it was an injury in college that he had, I want to say.
An ACL.
Yeah, so he was hurt in college, didn't play in 2019, his draft year, obviously didn't play in 2020 because of COVID. And then last year he also missed some time early on, too, with the hamstring injury, and he ended up making it to Lake County. So, and he comes from a super small school. So, A, you've got two missed minor league seasons. He comes from a very small school where the competition probably wasn't great. And all of a sudden, in 2022, he's in Akron with very little minor league reps and facing the best pitching he's ever seen in his life. So he started off pretty slow, but things have really gotten better for him as late. So I'm encouraged by that. And the overall numbers don't look like fantastic, but they also are starting to look pretty decent. I don't know. I'm interested to see. He's another guy who is Rule 5 eligible this winter. Not that I'm considering thinking they need to add him, but, you know, he's popping up again.
Yeah, but he's a guy that ends up, if you're not careful, a bench piece elsewhere or in a trade as the third or fourth piece, you know. Good development. I couldn't help but sit here and think how his brother played at UCLA, and here he's playing at a small school in California that I can't even remember, you know. And guess which one of the two of them has the professional career now, you know, the one at the small school, and he's in Double-A. And looks like he could be, you know, major league bound within the next year even. I think you could make that case for Priest because he has that versatility to play first base and I would say left field, maybe some right and DH too. So there's a potential bench piece there, whether it be for Cleveland or wherever. You know, I suspect he's one that is being developed for elsewhere, so to speak. But I think a good prospect nonetheless.
Yeah, 24 years old, out of Point Loma Nazarene University is where he went to college. I believe that's in California. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Yeah, so. Still some swing and miss, but, I mean, that's a guy that's probably going to develop slowly. And I should say it's going to take some time for him to adjust. And he had a tough start to the season. Now he is adjusting, but because of his background – like, those are guys that just don't come into your system overnight and start hitting. And with his background so far and his story so far, but it hasn't really – I don't know. He's still playing better than I thought he would, to be honest with you, given what I saw last year. Even I thought he was too old for Lynchburg. But speaking of background –
more of a development thing than it was an age thing for him. I'm missing those 2 years coming from a small school.
Speaking of Akron, here's a couple quick hitters we can get to. They blew their playoff chance on Sunday. They'll get another shot in the second half, but they could have won Sunday and clinched a playoff berth already. Gavin Williams, worst start of his pro career, 39 pitches in the first inning. Didn't make it out of the first inning. I know a lot of people were asking about that. Cleveland generally doesn't let their prospects throw more than 30 pitches in an inning because it was an important day and because they didn't want to burn their bullpen, which they had to do anyway. They pushed him to 39 pitches, and he didn't get out of the first inning. So that's why he was out early. I know the home plate umpire was not super kind to him, but he also had some tough ones too. So you'll have that. Not too worried there, obviously. And on another Akron note, Daniel Espino is supposed to be throwing again in Arizona. And it sounds like, Zach Meisel reported yesterday that he was also dealing with some shoulder soreness too, on top of the knee pain. So that makes some sense that knee tendonitis shouldn't have kept him out this long. It was obviously the shoulder that cropped up after. So, but it's good to see that he is throwing, and I'd imagine we'll see him back at Akron again this year, considering it's only June. So very happy to see that.
I'm not overly concerned with that. I think you rev up, you shut down, you start up again. You're asking for something like that. I think it's them probably being proactive and handling him with kid's gloves. You know, I don't know anything in the background, so to speak, but that's just my impression of it. I think it seems like he was revved back up about a month ago and we hadn't heard anything. And then now we're here and he's back. So I suspect that's where the shoulder started barking, and that happens. I mean, especially when you put your body through that roller coaster, it was just bound to happen. I think, you know, I won't red flag him and say that's anything serious or major.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think so. They wouldn't be letting him throwing if they didn't think he was healthy. That's the important thing. And
yep.
I wonder if the shoulder, you know, because they said that the start before he finally came out with the knee injury, they said that he had some issues to start before. So I wonder if there was anything going on where the shoulder, you know, he was starting to compensate with the shoulder, although it sounds like the shoulder popped up after the knee injury. So mm-hmm. I wonder if something was going on where he was compensating a little bit, which you don't want to get into. So, you know, you shut that down quick. Like you said, handle with kid gloves because this is your top prospect. Okay. So that was, what I was going to ask you, because we are going to be doing after the draft, we are going to re-rank the our prospect rankings for the site. So would you consider, I know we had Valera 1, Espino 2 going into the year. Does the injury and the time missed for Espino, does that automatically disqualify him from being considered for the top prospect on our list, do you think? Or do you still consider flipping him and Valera despite the injury?
I think the injury does play a factor. You have to perform. You have to be and stay healthy. We've punished, so to speak, other guys like Nolan Jones who have slipped down the rankings, and Tyler Freeman because surgical intervention, but surgery wasn't needed for Espino. Surgical intervention, when there's surgery involved, there's always, a higher risk, or the fact that a second surgery could be involved later on at another point. When there's a non-surgical intervention and it's just time off for inflammation or something like that, I don't take it as seriously. But when a guy has missed 2 months of development time, I do think that you have to dial it back a little bit with him. If I could put a 1A and a 1B, I would, but I can't. You know, I think that's part of the thing. And that's been one of my knocks on Valera in the past, is he's not stayed healthy every year. He's been dinged up. And that's part of the reason that I would have him on the table in the right trade for the right outfielder, Brian Reynolds and David Bednar. But big game hunting there, by the way. But I think, you know, kind of using what we've used in the past and applying it evenly to players, I think that you have to promote Valera to 1 and Espino has to slide to 2, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, that's what we had going into the season, because we weren't sure about Espino's command and his command mm-hmm. in his couple starts he made this year, which took a huge step forward. All of his stuff looked amazing, and he was pitching like, I mean, if he had continued on the path he was on to start the season, and Valera has been red hot in the month of June too, so it's hard to discount what he's done. I would have probably had Espino 1, Valera 2, but I'm with you. I think I continue to have Espino 2 just because he did miss the time with the injury. And then, you know, the knee wouldn't have been so bothersome. And obviously we don't think the shoulder is a big problem, but anytime you hear shoulder injury, not surgery, for a pitcher, you know, you cringe a little bit because shoulders are almost worse than elbows. And, not that we know the severity, obviously, but I think you're right. Applying what we've done in the past where, it is a tougher case because we did ding Freeman a little bit in our rankings because that was his second shoulder surgery. I mean, he was our top prospect in 2021, and then he was dropped to, I think, what, 3 or 4 for us, maybe 4.
Yeah.
But that was his second shoulder surgery on the same arm, so you have some concern there, and he missed half the season last year. But Espino didn't have surgery. We've dinged the Tommy John guys. He doesn't have Tommy John. So I don't know. It's going to be an interesting case. I think I lean Espino 2, Valera 1, just because of the time missed. But I don't know. The upside for Espino is really good. So it's going to be interesting to see where it goes. Speaking of injury.
I will say this. This is our first conversation about rankings at all. You and I haven't really bounced rankings around because my focus has been entirely on the draft. I think that's – we're both on the same page without even really having – had prior conversation about it, you know, having not talked about how to do that, how to rank that. But I'll say this, is that if Espino were to come back and get a few starts in and he looks as good or not, if not better, then I think there's a strong case that, hey, he doesn't lose any ground, you know, because I think that they were finessing this a little bit with him just to protect him from himself, so to speak. And that seemed to be what they floated out there. Obviously when a player misses 2 months, there's something more going on. Well, the something more was, okay, it was a knee and then it was a shoulder. And why was the shoulder inflamed? you know, it could have been overcompensation. It could have been, like I said, the yo-yo that he was putting his body through. I think you're asking for things like that to pop up when you do that. When you rev up, you slow down. You rev up, you slow down. You're going to get muscle pulls, inflammation, things like that. It just happens naturally.
Yeah, you're right. The start up and slow down is the hardest thing to do for sure, to get your body ready, and then all of a sudden to stop and then start again. It's very difficult. So 100% right. And then they made the right move being super cautious with him. I guess we'll see Tuesday on Gabriel Arias. So for those who haven't followed around over the weekend, Gabriel Arias came back, I think, on Saturday. He came back for the first time to Columbus after he had the broken bone in his hand. He played a couple games out in Arizona for the Complex League squad just to get revved up again. Well, then he got hit by a pitch in the elbow on Saturday night after it was his third at bat. So he came out of the game for that. Luckily, he was okay. He was in the lineup on Sunday. Well, then Sunday, in his first at bat, he fouls the ball off home plate, and the ball bounces up and hits him in the face, and he had to leave the game then. So I don't know what Gabriel Arias is doing, but the guy needs, like, to burn some sage or do some sort of dance. I don't know what it is, man, but I don't want to go anywhere near him right now with his bad luck. I would be like, don't call me, don't text me, just, you know, do what you got to do to get right. Yeah, seriously, I don't know, it's like someone's got a voodoo doll for him. Like, hopefully he's okay. I don't know. It didn't look like he was in any, I didn't cut anything. I guess maybe he came out for fear of concussion, but
sure.
We'll see Tuesday, but yeesh. It was the first chance we had to see Gabriel Arias play short and Tyler Freeman playing second, which I would say could have been your infield of the future in Cleveland, but Andrés Giménez looks like he is putting a stop to two guys coming up. It's going to be him and whoever else plays next to him one of these days or one of these years or the next decade after Ahmed Rosario signed to a 10-year extension. Every time I think that
center fielder of the future.
Oh, boy, they went there already. I think that's one thing for sure. They stopped playing on the left field again. It's like, okay, well, I don't know. I don't want to get back into that, to stop and start with him in left field. So, Gabriel Arias, we hope for the best. We'll get some quick hits here on some AAA guys as well. Will Brennan, another fantastic series. I think he had 8 hits against Omaha in the 6 games, or 11 hits or something. Man, he is just red hot. I don't know. I know we've had past conversations, Willie, about Brennan being a fourth outfielder type or a fringe starter, but every time he keeps hitting, I just have a hard time thinking the guy can't be a regular.
I have a rule of thumb that I'll apply to some of these guys. And, you know, I use a certain percentage. I'll knock it off of their batting average. And I ask myself, okay, this guy's hitting .320 in AAA. Can he hit .290 in the majors? And I don't think he could hit. Well, no, with Brennan, I do think he could hit .290. I suspect he's more .275, .280 hitter. As a major leaguer, which is still a good hitter, you know. But he's somebody that would not surprise me to see hitting .280 or .290. I always try to lower my expectations with guys too. But, I mean, he's just had an excellent year. I don't think you can ask for a better season from a prospect, you know, especially a guy that was almost in the 40s in rankings.
I mean, Fangraphs, they didn't have him on their list.
Yeah.
They didn't even do a write-up on him. And I think him along with Tanner Bibee, which we'll get to in a second too, those two guys have flown up the list for me, and they both, to me, have major league futures. The question is going to be, are there major league futures in Cleveland or somewhere else? Because that's where things start. I'd hate to lose either of them because of the development we've seen this year from them, but if other teams are buying into their development this season, they are really good trade commodities without trading. You know, it's almost like the Padres where, you know, they didn't trade any of their top 5 prospects, but they traded, you know, 15 through 30.
Yeah.
I wonder if Bibee and Brennan are two guys that fall into that list because of how they
played. And I've talked in the past about trading guys at their peak value. You know, I suggested, you know, Zavion Curry was peak value last year. I don't think his value has gone up this year, you know. Not knocking Zavion Curry. I like him. I think he's going to end up being potentially a fifth starter, possibly a bullpen arm. But, you know, I think you have a guy like that, you, when you have peak value, it's a good time to move them. You never want to trade anybody when they're at their lowest. That's for sure. But I like Brennan still as a potential role player for Cleveland. You know, I wonder if Cleveland does go big game hunting, so to speak, and looking for an outfielder. And let's say that they are in love with Brian Reynolds. They've been tied to him before. Do you try to include a Miles Straw in that deal? Or, you know, if you're not going to move George Valera, then you're going to end up likely moving an outfielder back and either Daniel Espino or a Gavin Williams and maybe a Brian Rocchio and a couple of other guys in the deal too. Who's the next outfielder beyond George Valera that, you know, that's ready? Are you going to deal a Stephen Kwan? Are you going to deal a Will Brennan in a trade? I think there's a good possibility that, you know, we see the franchise alter a few positions there. I think you end up with a Kwan either dealt or Captain a Brennan dealt or a Valera dealt, you know, and, you know, you start moving guys around. But I don't think they're going to be ready to cut bait on Miles Straw to go to an upgrade of Brian Reynolds just yet anyways, though. You know, I mean, that's my opinion. Again, you'd be selling Straw at his lowest, and you don't lock him up for 5 years or whatever it was, I don't recall, with and then turn around and trade him just a few months later.
No, I mean, you're right on Straw. I think you don't, but at the same time, his contract is also tradable. If you were to, say, go out and get Brian Reynolds, even though Straw is not the centerpiece of that deal, he's still young, that gives the Pirates a cost-controlled player who's still very good, and it's not a sunken contract, or what do they say, a sunken cost. So they're not underwater with that contract yet, and I don't know if they ever will be, because it's not, you know, big money.
Not tremendously costly, and he's still going to be a solid player. Excellent defense, speed. What he brings to the table, there's a lot of attributes that teams would love, you know, and I'm sure teams would love to have him if he were to be made available. I just don't think Cleveland will want to flip him, so to speak, at his lowest value unless the other team is asking for him. But I don't see Miles Straw at the same time holding them back from getting Brian Reynolds. And Brian Reynolds' best value is as a center fielder, not as a left fielder. You know, so there's that. I think that then you're brought back to, okay, it's either trade a Straw or, you know, you're going to trade a Kwan or a Brennan if it's not Valera, but you're going to have to make up for it with a Rocchio and a Williams or an Espino or Arias or somebody like that. And does Pittsburgh need shortstops, you know? Not when they have O'Neill Cruz and then...
because O'Neill Cruz is two shortstops. He's 6'7". He's two shortstops in one.
That's right. He's two for the price of one.
Yeah.
Buy one, get one free.
Yeah, they're going to value Straw highly too. Remember, the Cleveland always sets a high value on their players, and they don't come off the value. So you either meet their value or there's no deal. There's no meeting in the middle with Cleveland, so that'll be interesting. For what you said about outfielders and Valera and Brennan, for me, I think Brennan is clear-cut number two behind Valera now, with Kwan graduating off the list, obviously. I think Brennan's clear number two, and that's not even close for me. Tanner Bibee, 10 strikeouts last week for Lake County. He's going to fly up our list as well. Alexi Planez is going to be another interesting one because he has one walk this year. One walk the whole year. And he's got, I think, 8 home runs in the month of June. He's been hot, but, man, he makes Oscar Gonzalez look very patient at times. But he's hitting, so been waiting for that for Planez. I don't know. I said that Oscar Gonzalez's approach wouldn't work, and it's so far it's working, but I'm not changing my mind on Planez and his approach. That's even more extreme. He does strike out a little bit more than Gonzalez, but clearly he's talented.
And then, you know, hopefully that emphasis on taking more pitches will sink in with Planez. It might do him well, but definitely an intriguing bat. I think it's a long road for him ahead. So I'll just say it that way.
Yeah. A lot of juice in that bat. And then, Lynchburg did clinch their playoff spot. They're the only team so far in the organization in the minor leagues to clinch a playoff spot. The clinching game was a seven-inning doubleheader performance from Jack Leftwich. So he pitched the second half of the doubleheader, which is a complete game for a doubleheader. Eight strikeouts, one run. Jack Leftwich, I talked to him last week for my other outlet, and he seems really interesting. He's trying to work on getting the fastball to ride a little more because a lot of guys who throw his slider usually throw sinkers, so he can throw his slider with a rising fastball. He'd be really unique. He said he thinks his changeup's coming along really good this year. It's funny, him and Tommy Mace were best friends in college, and Tommy Mace had another rough start on Sunday. I would almost flip those two. I'm kind of surprised they weren't on the same team because maybe Cleveland wanted to break them up for once, but I would almost flip. I'd almost have Tommy Mace be pitching in Lynchburg and have Jack Leftwich in Lake County because Jack Leftwich has continued to impress, and I think he's at the point where he has done enough at that level where he needs a new challenge, and so does Tanner Bibee. So the second that anything happens, you know, Adam Scott starting the bullpen in Columbus, and I don't know what's going to happen up there with Battenfield and Pilkington and all those guys, but, you know, Cantillo or Logan Allen, who, by the way, struck out 11 last week again, geez, or Hunter Gaddis go to AAA, Bibee goes to Akron, and I would like to see Leftwich get to Lake County. But I would almost flip those two to be the way they're playing.
Yeah, Mace has had a disappointing season. Leftwich, I think, was placed in Lynchburg because of the development with the changeup, because it lags behind, or it was lagging behind. And he's a guy that was really jerked around at Florida to, you know, cut the crap and just call it honestly. He was jerked from one role to the other. And him being a team player the way he is, he came in and served as a fireman and did what was asked of him. But that's not good for his long-term development, especially as professional, you know. And I like the fact that they have stuck it out with him as a starting pitcher. You know, you and I said that, hey, he's going to be a reliever and he could move fast. Well, they've not gone that route. He would have potentially, I don't know, been in Akron by now, in my opinion, if he wasn't a relief role. But keeping him a starting pitcher also keeps that value for him as a starting pitcher. You know, he's a starting pitcher until he's not, you know, kind of like Noel being an outfielder. He's an outfielder until he's not.
Right. Exhaust the option, as we talked about in the past.
Sure.
Make the player tell you. And so far he's telling them that he can start, and we'll see what happens from there. But man, I've really been impressed with what I've seen from Leftwich, and I'm impressed with what I took away from that interview, how he's grown up and being the team player that he was at Florida. So we'll see what happens there. Let's get to some draft stuff real quick, Willie, before we get to questions, because we're already at the 45-minute mark and you know how we are. So this week, for those who don't know, and we can bring up other draft stuff as well, but this coming week it's going to be interesting how this plays out for us, at least for me and my future relationship. My anniversary is on Wednesday, and we're going out to dinner at 8 o'clock at a very nice restaurant. And Wednesday is also the Prospects Live mock draft for the 2022 MLB draft. And Willie has participated for a couple years now, and I have done my best to not screw his thought process up on things and keep things interesting. So Willie's going to be driving somewhere and making the pick from his phone, and I'm going to – now, he won't be driving. Someone else is driving, right?
My wife will be driving. She's designated driver Wednesday.
Yeah, so Willie will be a passenger driving somewhere Wednesday night making the pick, and I am hoping to be available to explain our pick on the air, although if Willie gets back before we're on the air, then I think – I don't know. We'll see how that goes, but – I might be stepping out of my anniversary dinner to do a quick phone interview on Wednesday. But yeah, Prospects Live Draft. Yeah, I have to go to the bathroom for about – it's, you know, those interviews are short. They're 5 minutes, so that's about how long it takes. But yeah, so Wednesday at 7:30 on Prospects Live YouTube channel. This has been – if you're an MLB draft fan, this has been one of the most fun events the last – I think it started in 2020 when, of course, we had nothing left to do. You know, they got – 30 people from Twitter, from different, you know, writing outlets and different backgrounds making picks for organizations they cover. So there's a lot of big names. There's Jeff Ponce from Baseball America. I know somebody from The Athletic is making the pick for the Orioles. I believe it's Melissa Lockhart, or she's the editor now at The Athletic, but there's just a ton of really great people. Brian Sikowski of Perfect Game is making the pick for Detroit, and then Willie and I are going to try to make the pick for Cleveland. So, and keep up with those guys. That'll be fun. So tune in at 7:30 on Wednesday on YouTube. I'll post the link on Twitter. Don't want to miss that, but I guess Willie, without saying too much more, what are our thoughts when going into Wednesday's mock draft as we pick for Cleveland at number 16?
I'd actually like to get the pick right this year.
Yeah, we haven't done that yet. We haven't done that yet.
Mock drafts are fun, and they can be very interesting because some people will be very serious about their approach to it, and they will stick to what they feel their team does. Cleveland being a model-driven team, I lean toward that philosophy. I take a more serious approach. I will approach the pick as if I thought what Cleveland would or what Cleveland might would do with the pick. Other people will just go for, hey, this is all fantasy and fun, and I'm going to make the funnest pick of the draft. You know, I think a lot of the guys and gals, because there are a lot of women writers out there too. A lot of the writers who do the draft though, take it very seriously, you know, but sometimes your plans go awry when the player that you think that Cleveland is keying on is picked just, Cleveland or whoever is picked just ahead of you, then you have to alter your plan and go with next man up. And that's the reality of a draft. I think you kind of pick that up. You know, I participated in one on Twitter with Down on the Farm. Down on the Farm is a Twitter follow who covers baseball content. And I don't know that he's put the whole mock draft out, but myself, fan, probably 20 other writers. Some of them, if you heard the names, you'd probably recognize them, participated in that. And, you know, Justin's going to be covering this one and I'll be making the pick. But Justin, myself, and Jared will serve as the brain trust for Cleveland with this pick. And, you know, as I said, the approach is to go after a player that we feel like Cleveland would target with that pick at 16. The thing is, you know, we base it on rumors and base it on things that we hear, but we don't know. Sometimes there's smoke screens and there's a lot of false flags, so to speak, out there to kind of, hey, look over there, there's a squirrel. And, you know, I'm
that would not be good for people like us.
Squirrel.
Yeah.
All of that to say that, you know, we're going to take the approach of going with who we feel Cleveland would take. So you're going to hear names like Zach Neto that, you know, Justin and I talked about off air, the shortstop from Coastal Carolina. Excellent hitter. He's not as fast as your premium athlete shortstops typically are. And the video I've seen of him, he looks like he's a little bit thicker in the lower half than what I thought you would see from a shortstop. My mind gravitated to he's a potential third baseman, but it sounds like a lot of people believe that he has the instincts to stick at shortstop. A guy with an excellent approach, something that Cleveland loves is those guys that will take an excellent approach. You see that on the major league club right now, but I'll throw a few more names out that, you know, you keep on hearing prep arms being associated with Cleveland. And Owen Murphy is one. Robbie Snelling is another one. I think Jackson Ferris is another name to know. Probably Brandon Barrera, too. I saw Brock Porter was linked to Cleveland at one point in time, too. He would be a little bit older than what Cleveland typically goes after because he's almost 19 already, but he is a cold weather arm from Michigan. And then there's a couple of other guys like Justin Crawford and Jett Williams. I think those two prepsters make a lot of sense for Cleveland. In fact, I come up with a draft predictor, and it's pointing toward it's pointing toward a prep bat this year, which seems to be a scarcity. Normally, there's more prep bats, it feels like, in the first round of the draft. And there's really Justin Crawford, who's been tied a lot to the New York Mets. And then there's Jett Williams, the shortstop from Texas, who has excellent basketball skills. I think can probably stick around shortstop, but if he doesn't, he can play center field with ease, has plus speed. He's just a really good player. Somebody that you'd probably put at the top of the lineup and not worry about. Justin Crawford, obviously the name rings a bell because that is Carl Crawford's son. So you got bloodlines there, a kid from Nevada, played at Bishop Gorman, I believe the same high school as Bryce Harper. Elite game-changing speed for Crawford. I think that's one of his calling cards. Excellent defense. Very slim frame still. He's 6'3", 175, a guy that I think will fill out and add muscle and with that more power. But he's getting 55 hit tools. Above average is typically what you would look for from Cleveland. So you're going to look for guys with that above average hit tool, and Crawford checks that box. And then I'll throw out a couple of college arms as potential picks there too, which is Cooper Hierp. I'm not sure how you say the last name. And I think Justin Campbell could, because he checks boxes for Cleveland. He's only 21-1, has that high over the top arm slot, excellent control, throws four pitches. You know, again, all things that Cleveland will emphasize, and a guy I think that would come in under slot. I think all the prep chatter around Cleveland is probably fishing for a prep arm at pick 37 in the competitive balance round. And if you look at their recent history, they've drafted most recently Tanner Burns, but they've also drafted Ethan Hankins, Lenny Torres, and Tristan McKenzie, all with compensation draft picks. So I think that's probably where they lean when the competitive balance round rolls around in July.
That's a lot. And I can tell you right now what's going to happen is Willie is going to make whatever pick he's going to make while his wife is driving the car, and I'm going to get on the air with the Prospects Live team if I'm doing the interview, and I'm just going to talk about how it should have been Cooper Zerpe, and it's probably not going to be Cooper Zerpe, and then I'm going to spend 5 minutes talking to them about Cooper Zerpe, and we picked Jett Williams, and they're going to be like, what is happening here? Because I'm going to be upset. No. In the last couple of days, I've been trying to do my homework, cramming for finals a little bit so I don't sound stupid, and love Jett Williams a lot. I think either you and Jared have both been on him. I'm excited to see or to get a longer look at him or talk about him a little bit more. Justin Crawford, like you said, fits a lot of boxes. I think he's just as exciting, although like you said, he also has had links to other teams above Cleveland. I don't know. Cooper Zerpe seems like a good fallback option at 16 if those guys are off the board, which I don't know. I don't think I've seen a mock draft where Jett Williams went above Cleveland's pick, so I think he would most likely be there, but I guess we'll see.
There's MLB.com has had him several times to the Padres at 15, so right in that range. And to me, Crawford and Williams are about interchangeable. You know, I threw out my prospect grades on their tools to you and Jared the other day, and I think if you add them up, they tally up to the same score, so to speak. Well, you know, one has elite speed, the other one has a better bat, you know, and Crawford has better defense, but overall they're both going to be, I think, high quality prospects. I think Crawford has the higher ceiling. You know, and you brought out talking to me off of the podcast just before, what about Dylan Lesko? Do I think Dylan Lesko would be a possibility for Cleveland? Absolutely. I think Cleveland looks unique this year. Kind of like Khalil Watson going 16 last year to the Marlins. Pick 16, it just seems to be a pick where there's a unique player that slides for whatever reason. Khalil Watson, I think because of his price tag, but also the knocks on his height, because he's just 5'8", I think 5'8", 5'9". And then Matt McClain slid last year, who would, I think, is an excellent, you know, prospect that could have went top 10 last year, and he slid down to the Reds before they snagged him. So there's possibility that, you know, Cleveland is sitting here in what if Connor Prelip is on the board. I think that's a unique opportunity for them as well. Some thought he was the number one pitcher in the country coming into this year. And, you know, he's come back and he's looked pretty good from what I've seen in the video of him. Not quite peak velocity since the return from Tommy John surgery, but he is unique in that while you have all of these other pitchers, I think there's seven or eight pitchers who are out with Tommy John. Prelip is now recovered from Tommy John. So you get post-recovery Prelip, and you get a knock on value, so to speak. A guy that would have been top five pick is now coming down the board to picks probably 15 or later, you know. I think that could be a unique opportunity for them if he's there as well.
Yeah, and Scott Barnsby's still running the draft for Cleveland, right? That's right?
Yes.
Okay. He was not running the draft when these picks were made, but I go back to, for prep arms in the first round for Cleveland, I go back to the special cases. And I know we're talking about, you know, Tristan McKenzie and Juan Hillman were both competitive balance picks, so I'm not counting them here in this discussion, but when I see prep arm for Cleveland in the first round, I look back and I think, okay, you have Brady Aiken. Obviously, it didn't work out, but special case because he was 1-1 the year before and there was value there as he was sliding and you know they thought they were getting a 1-1 type player and obviously it didn't work out. But you have Ethan Hankins who slipped because of injury concerns who you know had Tommy John. He's obviously out so far this year. He should be back sometime next month. Still has pitched well in his pro debut so far. Daniel Espino, I think, slid because of other teams' concerns, and they felt that they could bet on the athlete and the player, and there was value there. So every time I feel like they've taken a prep arm in the first round like that, it's always been on the case basis of value and guys they thought shouldn't have been there. And maybe it's just the way things have panned out, but like we're talking about a Robbie Snelling doesn't seem to fit that. I know there's value, you know, untapped potential there, and there's value there. But he doesn't quite fit the same mold, I guess, as the other guys. Maybe Dylan Lesko and Connor Prelip are more in that case. Does that sound about right? Do you think that those guys kind of fit more of their history? And I know Connor Prelip's not a prep arm, but I guess he falls into the value proposition of taking an arm at 16 right now. But Lesko to me fits that if he's there, if they really feel like, you know, he's a no high school right-hander has ever gone 1-1, obviously, but if he's a 1-1 talent, which he could be, I don't know. That's the only way I can see.
So I view Lesko as a top five talent if healthy. So I think in one mock I had him as high as number four, or I had him as at five in a mock early on. And I think that's the range that he was probably looking at if he were healthy. Excellent
control. He never would have gotten to Cleveland.
No, he would have never got to Cleveland. Excellent control. All of his pitches are above average or better, up to 97. But the thing is, such a polished arm and so young, so to speak. I know a lot of teams really coveted him, and then he went down requiring Tommy John surgery. So I tend to think that if you're going to go after a Tommy John arm, you should go after a Tommy John college arm, not a prep arm. And I'll use my theory that I used before because I said I wanted Walker Buehler whenever they drafted Brady Aiken. But I've heard and I've read reports that said that the average arm only lasts 7 to 8 years post Tommy John surgery before requiring a second surgery. So if you're doing that with a prep arm, you're losing a couple of years of service time, essentially, through development. But if you have a college arm, you can they'll move a little bit faster. You're not looking to start a college arm, essentially, in rookie ball or in low A, where you could move him to Lake County right away once he's healthy and Prelip's healthy now. So you can move him right away to Lake County. Next year is when they would do it. You know, that's the thing with Cleveland is they're not going to rush a lot of their draft picks out this year. I know that was a question later on about draft picks offsetting some of these promotions and stuff from Nunzio. I think it will only affect four or five players. I'll put it to you that way. I think they only promoted four or five last year. I think it'll only affect four or five players this year. I think that's the way that you would – or that's the way that I would handle – a Tommy John recovery arm is I would go for the one who was a college arm. And preferably, in my opinion, of the two would be Connor Prelip over Dylan Lesko, just for that sheer philosophy.
Yeah, we'll see where they go. I mean, I don't know. Like you said, there's been different things going around about being around prep arms or bringing around other pitching types. Their high school hitting's good. College hitting has been good this year. I think we saw a mock that had Chase DeLauder going to them, which really stunned me. And I'm out on him because of the swing issues. I know some people don't want to hear that, but I was excited about Chase DeLauder coming into the season, and now I'm not so excited. And I don't know. I'm kind of focused myself on either Cooper Jerpy or Jet Williams or Justin Crawford at this point at 16. And I do have concerns about Cooper Jerpy being able to hold his velocity in pro ball every 5 days. And if they were to make a mechanical change to kind of help him unlock more velocity, does that offset his unique delivery that gives him deception and another kind of, you know, interesting qualities that make him an interesting pitcher? You know, I don't know, but definitely stay tuned to Wednesday to see what happens. Obviously, we have to have a plan A, B, C, and D because a lot of things could happen. I guess essentially you need 17 picks, right? Because you're picking 16 and things could go any which way. So you have to have a whole bunch of guys on the board to see where they go. So we'll finalize that this week. That'll be fun. And then we'll ramp up the draft coverage here in a couple weeks because, what, the draft is, four weeks away? We're a month out? Less than a month out?
Less than a month out. We're about three weeks away. July the 18th, I think, is when it starts, the 18th through the 20th of July.
Yeah, so next Monday is July 4th, so we will not have a podcast on July 4th. Maybe we'll get together on the 5th. We'll see. But I would expect that the July 11th, we will have a very draft-heavy podcast, and we will have more podcasts or more draft content coming your way that week. So stay tuned for that. Let's do some questions and get out of here. What do you think, Willie? Sound good?
Sounds good to me.
All right. A short list of questions this week, four from two different people. So Nunzio Izzo's first question was, with the first half finish, as Willie alluded, expecting more movements such as Logan T. Allen to Columbus, perhaps a corresponding move to Bobby for Akron, which those two things should go hand in hand whenever they do happen. Anyone else we're anticipating? I don't know. I would think that if Bobby goes to Akron from Lake County, I would expect that you'll see either Trenton Denholm or Jack Leftwich or Will Dion or any of those guys should be in Lake County at some time in the second half. Depends on what arms they have to replace those innings in Lynchburg, though, is the question, because I don't think Ryan Webb is quite ready to go out to Lynchburg. And as you said, Willie, they are not going to push their draft picks out. By the way, Ryan Webb has not pitched since June 21st, so I guess that was a week ago, so I guess he's due to pitch this week.
I went back and looked at that, and his prior start was June 6th, and his next start was June 21st, so it was 15 days in between starts. He went one inning the first one. He went two innings the second one. I suspect they had him probably throwing on the side, building him back up slowly that way, and possibly working on a few mechanical things with him because they have changed his arm swing a little bit. So that's probably them just kid's gloves again and building him up and protecting him. So I wouldn't make too much out of, you know, that time in between starts for him, even if there is a big gap between the next one even.
Yeah, so the problem with that is I don't think, you know, Ethan Hankins is going to come back, but I don't think he's going to be obviously not going to be throwing four or five innings, so he can't come back as a starter right away because he's got to build him back up as well.
Opener, just like Carlos Vargas is doing.
Yeah, and Vargas finally pitched two innings the other day too. So, you know, Bybee probably will go to Akron. They do have a couple guys in Lynchburg that can go to Lake County, but the problem is I don't know if there are really any arms in Arizona you can bump to Lynchburg to replace these guys. I mean, just going back to the draft last year, I think Ryan Webb is going to require more time in Arizona just because he's still building back up. Mm-hmm. Zach Pettway and Tommy Ventimiglia, those guys are still kind of building up. Yorman Gomez and Abel Brito have been the best starters, I think, in Arizona Pettway so far. But they're
he's down. I think it was an elbow sprain, if I remember right.
Yeah. So there's no options. Yeah. So there's really nobody to send to Lynchburg. So that's why things are going to be a little bit interesting because, yeah, you might get Allen to Columbus. You might get Bobby to Akron, and then you can get one of, like, you know, Will Dion or Jack Leftwich to Lake County. But I think it's going to be limited from that end because They don't have the arms to replace guys in Lynchburg right now because all the guys in Arizona are just getting started and aren't built up. And I think it's going to take some time. And maybe you'll see one of the draft pick arms to make it to Lynchburg, but that's not, you know, for another month now or for another, 2 months. So,
yeah,
I think movement's going to be limited in that regard. That's part of the reason why you're seeing this, because they don't have the arms down at the lower level to replace that right now. So we'll see. His other question was, if Ahmed Rosario is dealt, do you see any movement on the infield? I can't see any movement on this infield. Agreed. Outfield locked in pretty well. Injuries, the only thing that breaks the logjam. I don't know. They could decide to trade Ahmed Rosario at the deadline if they feel like they want to move Jimenez to shortstop and
addition by subtraction.
Yeah, I don't know. The Ahmed Rosario thing is just still so weird because clearly he's not like a star level player, but he's like, you know, a good average regular. He was supposed to be a top prospect, so now we're all disappointed that he's not a star, and he's, you know, he's got a 95 WRC plus, and guess what, Willie, his career weighted runs created plus is 93. So what does that say? He is roughly a league average player.
Yep.
Over the career of 600 games played. So that's who he is. That's really who, and that's fine. That's a player that starts on almost every team in baseball. And he's not an above average shortstop by any means defensively. So he's not really offsetting, slightly league average offense, but that's a guy who starts for almost every team in baseball, unless you have a Xander Bogaerts or, Carlos Correa or, I don't know, Francisco Lindor, even though Jimenez has outplayed him this year.
They have been willing to trade players too, that even while they were competing for a division, they still have traded players while they were competing. Trevor Bauer was one that they traded while they were competing, and they brought back Puig and that whole package. So they've done it before where they've been willing to do that. The Rays have done it, and, you know, I think they've gotten better when they've traded for Meadows and Baz and Hurd, I can't remember his name. But the whole point is I could see that going either way. I don't think it's a sure thing Ahmed gets traded at the deadline. I think it's a possibility. I think it's 50-50, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I think someone's got to have a shortstop. Maybe he's right. Injury has to happen. But injury, you know, a contender could lose their shortstop for the year, and Ahmed Rosario suddenly looks like a really attractive option to them. And look, again, he is a 93 weighted runs created plus, so he is 7% less than the league average offensively for his career, and that's over 2,000 plate appearances. That's who he is. I mean, there's no change in that now. I know he's 27. He could, 26, he'll be 27 in the winter. So he could get a little bit better, but really he's going to be around league average offensively, and he's going to be a fringe average defender, and that's a nice player, but nothing he does over the next 2 weeks is going to change that. And I'm going to say this one more time, Willie. I'm going to say it. Showcasing doesn't exist. 2 weeks of a player's performance in AAA, the major leagues, AA, doesn't change a scout's opinion. Scouts have looked at 2,500 20 starts, 200 innings of guys playing to make their reports on a guy. 2 weeks doesn't change that. So promotions, a hot streak, those things don't change other teams' opinions on players. So, that's that. I'm just going to leave it at that. And we are not going to bring up the term showcasing on this podcast ever again because it does not exist. Chuck's two questions. Rank the three pitchers your highest on the system in order, not including Espino or Williams. Well, for me, that's Joey Cantillo. Allen, Cantillo, Bybee. That was easy.
Yeah. I would say those three, and I'll throw in Hunter Gaddis as a bonus.
Oh, I didn't. You know what? I didn't include Doug Nikhazy. I'm sorry. No, I can't in good conscience throw him there. But yeah, I think Hunter Gaddis is definitely in that conversation for sure. And there's a couple guys you can really throw in there. Honestly, it's tough. But as we said, it's tough.
I mean, Dak is looking really good too. So
there's I would.
Davion Curry.
I would throw him in there if he wasn't in high and low A. He needs to be in high A. That's the thing.
I'm higher on a guy like Hunter Gaddis than I am on Tanner Burns. And, you know, mm-hmm. I'll just leave that one there.
Hunter Gaddis is going to make some team very happy. I don't know if it's going to be Cleveland, but he is a heck of a pitcher. And I think I don't think it's going to be here, but we'll see. And then Chuck also wants to know if David Fry gets a chance in Cleveland. Now he's starting to get reps at catcher. I don't know. I think having a catcher who can also play first and third and have a little pop like he does, I think that's a very attractive option to have on the bench, especially for a manager like Tito, who does not like to pinch hit for his catchers because he doesn't like to have an emergency catcher.
But he would.
But you got to find room on the 44.
Where does he get playing time? Who would have to go to?
I don't know.
That's the thing. I think. You alluded to part of it is because of injury and part of it is because of Rivera's retirement. Now, Fry has played catcher before, and he was brought here or traded here, I think, on part because of that positional versatility, because he could play catcher, and they've played him at first base and third base, so I think, exclusively until this point. So I think Fry could play on a major league club as a 25th, 26th guy, but I don't think that – I think he has a future as a major leaguer. I just don't think the future is going to be long. I'll put it to you that way.
Yeah, interesting option for sure. I don't know. We'll see. It's just, there's a lot of factors that go into where he could be and where he takes up a spot. And you also have to find room for him on the 40, which I don't know how you do that. So that's their hard part.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for the questions. Yeah, not here. Let's see. Last week, Willie, I'll let you determine who wins, although I already have an idea of who's going to win this. We had Megan on the podcast last week, who did a great job talking about the Clippers with us, as they had a bad week in Omaha, up and down week in Omaha. We didn't get to that kind of weird stuff. I had Joey Cantillo and Bo Naylor. Bo Naylor kind of had a rough start, although he hit a 462-foot home run yesterday, Willie. And Joey Cantillo, I think, had four walks, but struck out five and had five scoreless innings. Tyler Freeman had a much better week than Bo Naylor in Columbus. Peyton Banfield had one good start, one bad start in Columbus. So, I don't know. What do you think? That's a tough one.
Who do you think won?
No pressure. No pressure.
Who do you think won?
I don't know. Battenfield had one good start, one bad start, and Naylor had a bad debut in Columbus, but he had a long home run.
Essentially.
I had Cantillo, who had five shutout innings, but he did walk four.
How many strikeouts did he have?
I believe he had five.
Okay. And then who was Megan's
pick was her hitter was Tyler Freeman, who had a great series at Omaha, and he also hit a home run in that series. So
okay.
Battenfield gave yesterday. Let's see, Tyler Freeman this week had 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 hits, including a home run.
I think we have a winner.
Of course. All right. So we are going with the Battenfield. He had a good start. He had a bad start, so that's fair. All right. So Megan won last week's Player of the Week pick. So really, you, Megan, and John are 5-3 for the year, and I am 2-6. So the standings are quickly getting away from me this year. So
you get the first pick.
I knew you were going to say that. All right. I know we said we were going to stick to our picks for our teams, but
not entirely.
Yeah. I need a win so badly, so I'm going to go with Will Brennan as my hitter, and I think at pitcher I am going to go with
Logan, you know what? He was your money for you last year, Matt. Come on.
All right, I'll go with Logan Allen just to get a cheap win. I'll go with nobody interesting this week. Yeah, I'll go with Logan Allen. I won't be interested.
I'm not going boring easily or either, and I'm not going down easily. So I'm going with Tyler Freeman and Hunter Gaddis.
Oh, geez. This is going to be it's a week of the stars, really, is what it is. Nobody's trying to get cute here. Nobody's getting cute. We are just going. I mean, Hunter Gaddis is, like you said, it's really pitched his way into being a front, I don't want to say a frontline starter, but an option where he is a legitimate pitching prospect, starting pitching prospect. So
middle of the rotation type of starter. But they,
yeah. Yeah. So nobody's getting cute with their picks this week. I guess I got cute last week going with Bo Naylor and his AAA debut, and that burned me. So Cantillo wasn't a cute pick. Yeah. All right. Well, we are an hour and 20 minutes in, so have mercy on you if you have listened this long. Thank you. But also, why? thank you very much. Willie, thanks for taking the time to do this with me, as always. We will not be on next Monday. We'll see about next Tuesday. I don't know. Tuesday is always a tough day because that's when minor league action starts back up. Monday makes the most sense because there's no games, but we'll try to get a podcast together for Tuesday, and then the week after, for sure, we'll be ramping up draft content. So follow Willie on Twitter. It is WILLHOO99 on Twitter. I am JL_baseball, official_CGBI for the site account. Yep, keep an eye on all the stuff coming up soon. It's going to be very interesting. Good time to subscribe. And Willie, unless you got anything else, we'll catch you maybe next.
Sounds good.
Have a good one, everybody.